Welcome back, everyone. I'm so excited for today's episode. This is Let's Talk About Star Wars with me, Garrett Weinzierl, her, Jenny Josephson, and him, Tom Merritt. And this is our special second episode for the month of December because we are here to spoil everything about Rogue One, a Star Wars story. And that is the
Was I supposed to see that?
Oh, no.
Kidding.
Really?
Oh, I saw it twice.
You got me, not really, because you were talking about seeing it twice just before we started this recording.
I want to rebrand spoiling into glorifying and all the details thereof.
Yeah, it used to just be called wrapping up, like, or, you know, talking about.
Yeah.
Rather than spoiling.
Decompressing.
What has happened to our country? That's another podcast.
Star Wars came out. That's what happened.
But yeah, this is the only warning you're all going to get. If you're listening to this and expecting a not spoiler-filled discussion of the movie, I'm confused with what you expected. But yeah, we're going to talk about
Talk about Jar Jar Binks appearing. We're going to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about that sweet flashback to Anakin's pod racing.
Yep. Can't believe Darth Vader still pod races.
I know. Who'd have thunk it? I like his new pod racer design, though. It's great.
Yeah.
The red.
Yeah, pun one. Wait, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Oh, you. All right, yeah. So we'll most likely spoil just about every facet of this movie. But before we do that, we got to thank our patrons over at patreon.com/letstalkaboutstarwars for being the only sponsor of this maybe 12 episode a year podcast. If we even hit that, I think we did 11 this year.
12-ish.
Close to 12. Yeah. Close enough, you know.
Got 11 with good intent.
But we really appreciate those of you who actually go out of your way to support this show because we know it's weird and not nearly as regular as a lot of other podcasts. So we appreciate it. Thank you, guys. But
I feel the same way.
Yeah, guys, a new Star Wars movie is here. It still feels special, even though we know we'll most likely get a new Star Wars every year for the rest of our natural born lives. Before we get into the nitty gritty, I want to know our personal experiences. How did we all go see it? So let's start with Tom, because you're the only one of the three of us that have seen it more than once already.
Yes. So the first viewing was at 8 p.m., not 7 p.m., because I didn't have to wait in a Fandango queue for 35 minutes to get the 8 p.m. I could get it right away. Got the center seats in the row we always like. And I figured waiting an hour isn't going to make any big deal. By the time people might start wanting to talk about it on social media, I'll still be inside the movie theater. Not to mention the people in Europe who got to see it days before and whatever. So we went to our nearest movie theater, sat down in the middle, and were definitely surrounded by a bunch of other Star Wars fans because we were all laughing at things that you really have to know Star Wars to get. People seemed to have a great time, and there was applause at the end. So it felt awesome. It definitely felt different than A Force Awakens, though, because there were no special commemorative glasses. People weren't there early or dressed up in my showing or anything like that. But it was a fun time. And then, not to extend my time too long, the second showing I went to was specifically to take notes for Pretend I'm Dumb About Star Wars. So I went alone at 9:35 in the morning on a Saturday and sat up in the reserve level that Cinemark has where they have a table that I could set my notes on. And you get free popcorn. You can order drinks from your seat and stuff. And that viewing was very different. People were silent. Like almost no reaction, no applause at the end. But everybody did stick around for the credits, even though I got up and left because I already had seen them and knew there wasn't anything special coming there.
Mm. All right. Well, that actually sounds kind of delightful because I went Friday. I didn't go Thursday just because I wanted to see it with the same group of friends that we went and saw Force Awakens with last year. And they just couldn't do Thursday for whatever reason. Thanks, Ben and Abby. Jeez,
Ben.
So I stayed off Twitter entirely for Thursday evening and most of Friday until I went and saw it that night. Pretty packed theater. Not really anyone in costume. There was one kid dressed up like Krennic, which I found amusing. And then the entire row behind us was about 8 kids, which were just way too talkative and didn't listen to the one father figure that was like, guys, shh, be quiet. And he only did that twice and then just kind of gave up. So
So I went to the historic ArcLight Cinerama Dome on Sunset Boulevard at 10:30 at night because we were worried that Matt wouldn't get out of work in time because he's been working late. And then, of course, he was like home all day. So we went to a dinner beforehand. We got it was only four of us this time. You'll remember that last year for The Force Awakens, we did a whole row of people. But I was like, I can't do that every year. I'll go crazy. So we're doing it for the sagas only. And we sat down. Matt and his manager, Nick, went to the popcorn line and they never came back. And the trailer started.
Wait, what?
And everything started. And I started getting real Star Wars antsy because I was like, Matt cannot miss the opening of a GD Star Wars movie. And so you want to know how much I love my husband? In the middle of the third trailer, and they don't do that many trailers at ArcLight, I got up, went across a bunch of people and went to go look for him to make sure he hadn't had like a heart attack in the lobby. And he was just coming in with the popcorn. I was like, get to your seat. And so, but that's how much I love my husband, is that I was willing to miss the opening of Star Wars to make sure that he was alive. So we got there, we sat down, we watched a movie. And at the end, the people, we have a rule, Matt and I, it's like a very strict rule that we never really talk loudly about the movie until we've made it to the car. Like, part of that is because we just want to like bask in the glow of the movie or take a moment before we start ripping it to shreds, one or the other. And the people behind us were just like so loud and diving into everything the second after I've seen it. And we were like, don't you guys want to listen to the Michael? I think I even put up a hand that was like this. And when, since we're in video, you can see it. It was like, wait, it's out of frame. Let me do it again. It was really jerky, but I was just like, you guys, we just saw something. Well, we'll save that part. But so, yeah, that was my experience seeing it. Then we went home and talked about it for 2 hours.
See, I immediately, because of the friends I attended with, immediately started dissecting it the second the majority of the other human beings in our vicinity had vacated.
Right.
But
the first thing I said out loud in the theater, which I try very hard never to talk once the movie has started, but you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away came up and everybody's like whistling and like, yay. And then we see the planet and I just turned to Eileen involuntarily and went, cold open.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
Star Wars history.
I thought that worked pretty damn well, if I do say so myself.
I did too, except when they finally did get to the title card, I thought I was going to see Rogue One, a Star Wars story. We never saw the word Star Wars on the title card. I thought that was a little weird.
It's
deep.
We all know what we're there for, right? I mean,
yeah, like, no, it didn't ruin my appreciation of the movie or anything. I just thought it was odd. That's all.
That's like subscribing to a podcast and being like, man, they don't say the title until a minute into the music.
Well, yeah, it wasn't when they put it. It was just like, oh, it doesn't even use the word Star Wars on here.
Okay. I guess I get that. I didn't think about that until this very moment, Tom.
But it's a standalone movie.
That it is.
It's standing alone.
It is, even though it ties directly, and I mean seconds before, into A New Hope.
The thing I tweeted after we got out of the theater was, now that's a prequel. And I meant it on so many different levels. One is like, I really enjoyed this and it was a prequel. One was, that is literally like part one of A New Hope. Like, it leads right up. I did not expect it to lead up to the moments, you know, before the chase of the Tantive IV. And also a little bit, we'll get to our feelings about it. And my feeling overall is I really enjoyed it. But also, you know, there's a little bit of prequeliness in that it's different. It's not an episode. And a lot of people's criticisms of 1, 2, and 3 are they felt too different from 4, 5, and 6.
That's a really good point. So I think before we start going, you know, kind of scene by scene, let's go around the table. Like, so Tom, your overall feelings are, you enjoyed the film?
Yeah, it's interesting seeing it twice. The first time I came out of it, I was a kid with a smile on my face. I was 7 years old again. I loved every second of it. Every lingering long shot of blue milk was a joy to me. I thought it was great. I thought it was well paced. I had so much fun watching it, and it was a delight. The second time through, and maybe my opinion was colored a little bit because Eileen came out of it saying that was really good. I still like Force Awakens better. And I was like, I just don't know if you can compare the two. My second time through, I found it dragged a little at one point because I knew all the fun nostalgia beats that were coming. And unlike Force Awakens, I didn't come out of the second viewing needing to see it again. Mm. And I don't want that to sound too much like a criticism, because I almost never see a movie a second time to begin with. So this is already special because of that. But it definitely doesn't have as much depth for me of experience as the mainline episodes have.
Yeah. So my overall take was I do think in terms of structure, pace, and the introduction of multiple characters on the run, which is a very specific kind of way to introduce characters. I think this is one of the three best sci-fi movies to do that. And the other two are Star Trek 2009 and Guardians of the Galaxy, which is like introducing characters as they're running through things is a very particular art. And I thought this killed it at that. And I loved so much of it, and I cried and everything you want out of a movie. But like you, Tom, here's the crazy thing. I didn't feel this epic need to go see it again, because to me, I didn't want to see Cold Mountain again. I didn't want to see Schindler's List ever again. Like, it was a sad movie, and me seeing it once completely filled the experience for me. And I'm curious what that will do to the box office, actually.
That's a good point. That's kind of, I really do want to go see it a second time, but for me, it was dark for a Star Wars movie. And but I think for me I think after the second time I'll be done too. And I think that's more because in my first viewing, I legitimately had no idea how the movie was going to end,
is great.
Which, yeah, it was so unexpected for me, right? Or for most Star Wars fans, right? Because you know exactly what happens next. And I think that's such a, there's a lot, I have a lot of nitpicks with the movie, but I think the single greatest accomplishment is that. And it's kind of like, and I mean this with as much positivity as humanly possible, it's kind of like watching an M. Night Shyamalan movie again, and let's maybe just think about the good ones, of which I think there are two.
Yeah.
But it's like once you know the whole story, there is something lost knowing how it ends. And it's so weird because I didn't think that's what Rogue One was going to be. But you're absolutely right. And some of it is that it is it really does end on a dour note. I've spent over 2 hours falling absolutely in love with this cast of characters. And then by the end, you're just like, oh, I'm broken inside.
This is a spoiler cast, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody dies.
Everyone.
Everyone.
Person.
Everyone dies.
Yeah.
Okay. Like,
It is
the Hamlet of Star Wars. It is a war movie. Like, it's a war movie. And so everybody you spent two movies caring about dies, and you'll never hear from them again unless they fill out their backstory with comic books and books, which I would imagine they might do.
I would,
but,
too.
Like, yeah. They're all gone.
Yep. Just...
And barely no one ever even knew they existed. That's the other thing, too.
The second of the team that went to Scarif that died tipped me off. I'm like, oh, I don't think anybody's making this out here. But even then I was like, maybe Jin will make it out. But I thought her, I can never remember his name. The captain.
Oh, Cassian. Diego Luna. That's what I call him.
Diego Luna.
Cassian.
What's his name?
Cassian. Cassian Andor.
I was like, I don't even think Cassian's making it out of this. And then when they both like did the end of the world sequence, you know, what's the movie? Looking for a Friend at the End of the World? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm thinking on the beach.
No, it's not that movie. There's a movie like that where they just sit down on the beach to embrace the tidal wave. I was like, oh, wow. Oh, yeah. No, they made that
the
call.
The other Comet movie, the non Armageddon Comet
Deep
movie.
Impact.
Where they just, thank you.
Deep
where they
impact.
Face the waves together, father and daughter, and it's super weird and depressing.
No, I was like, wow. And I think that's a bold choice. And I think it probably explains a lot of the reshooting that we heard about is trying to get that to not just leave people angry and sad. And one of the ways they did it was to give us hope. Like, it does end on hope. The fact that we see the Tantive IV get away, we see the plans get put into Princess Leia's hands, and we see Princess Leia to look at us in the eyes and say, hope, don't forget all about the next movie, which is all about hope. Don't be too sad.
Yeah. I mean, I was like wrecked. And it's not that I didn't expect that there would be losses, but I was just like completely wrecked and I loved it. But again, I was wrecked after a bunch of really sad movies and I don't ever want to see them again. So I'm sure I will see this movie again, but it's not like I want to go get it. Like, it's a charge of joy to my soul.
Yeah, no, no, I'm still in my, I want to go see it again mode, but I think I'm with you, Tom. I don't think it's going to be like Force Awakens where I'm just like, I could go see this once a week until it's not in the theaters anymore.
Oh yeah. I mean, I could put that movie on now, right? I could go upstairs and play it and I'd be perfectly happy.
Like, it's just fun. And that's the thing. Like, it's really hard to compare this to a saga film. But I've been like mulling it over with my friends over the weekend. And I think like, cause the comparison I always make, like with a lot of movies, like especially in a series, which is better, I always come back to Alien versus Aliens. And I would much rather watch Aliens, but I think Alien is the better movie. Like, it's just a better story and a much more like perfectly crafted film. But Aliens is just more fun, and I would just rather put that on, you know, if I have a cold one day and I don't want to pay attention to what I'm watching and just kind of have, you know, take my mind off things. And that, for me, I think I liked the story Rogue One told way better than Force Awakens, but I think I'll probably still end up watching Force Awakens far more, like, many times in my lifetime.
Well, and I think that is one of the strengths of Rogue One, is they did a really good job of coming up with a story, a good, solid story, and then fitting in the universe around it. So there's some people disagree with me, but I feel like Tarkin fits into a role that is dictated by the story. I think Vader fits in a role dictated by the story. I don't feel like they said, we need to throw Vader in this movie. Let's write him in. Like, everything felt like, yes, if Krennic has screwed up and wants to meet the Emperor, he's going to get summoned. And the person that's going to deal with him is Vader, because Tarkin isn't getting the job done. And that's what the Emperor would do. Like, that just makes sense to me. Tarkin, obviously, and part of this is because I read the book, but Tarkin has been struggling with Krennic for control of the Death Star. And even if you didn't read Catalyst, you'll get that. You'll be like, oh yeah, there's going to be a power struggle, and Tarkin, we know, wins. Mm-hmm. So he obviously would be there trying to wrest control away from Krennic and make him look bad. So that makes sense as well. All of those things made sense. I think the blue milk is the only one who didn't really make sense. Like, why would they have blue milk on that planet? But I guess it's just, you know, it's like, why do we have Coca-Cola everywhere? It's the same
thing. Why are we moisture vaping on a wet planet? I don't know.
Right. Well, because Bonanza, you got so much moisture.
Well, maybe that's it's how genius. Maybe that's how they purify it for drinking.
Yeah, maybe something. Yeah. I don't know.
And they so still look
we,
like.
Should we scene by scene it, or are we?
I think we're at the point now where we can start kind of moving through it in order. Okay. So starting with the cold open, this is kind of 15 years prior to everything else we're about to experience, and we see. And Tom, you've already invoked Catalyst. Which I haven't read, but I read the synopsis before the movie because I was just impatient. And so I know it specifically deals with Galen Erso and Krennic. So Galen, like, he was, in fill in the gaps for me, Tom, he basically worked on the Death Star, like, was forced into working for the Imperials, escaped with the help of Saw Gerrera, and Krennic has now tracked him down, and that's where we are at the beginning of Rogue One.
Yeah, he was working on Kyber Crystals. And if you don't want to be spoiled on the book at all, don't listen to what I'm about to say, but I'm not going to spoil the book. I just want to give you a little background on Galen Erso. He was working on Kyber crystals for power generation, and they were hiding the fact of what they were going to use all that power for from him. And when he found out about it, he escapes to the planet that you see him on at the beginning of Rogue One.
Okay, gotcha. And that's also where the Saw Gerrera connection is, because he escapes with
Right, and Saw Gerrera is someone they come to know in the book, and I won't talk about that, because that would be spoilery. And but yes, he is a friend of theirs.
Yeah. All right, so yeah, so that's, and that's where we come to in the beginning of the movie is Krennic showing up to Galen's kind of nomadic house. And Galen's trying to pull a fast one on him. He's trying to have his wife hide. They're trying to get Jin, who's a small girl at the start of this
perfectly
movie.
Perfectly cast little adorable fish muffin. Oh my God. So sad.
Did you say fish? I called muffin? Her
a little wayfish muffin.
Oh, I actually had one of those this morning from Katz's
Deli.
They're
delicious.
So good.
They're gluten free.
Yeah.
Yeah, adorable child actor, which Krennic clearly sees through immediately, because he sends his badass, are they called death troopers? I'm still learning my new...
The people who inspired the outfit of Captain Phasma many years later, troopers?
Apparently, I guess. Yeah, I guess they're called death troopers.
Death troopers, yeah, yep. I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Search the house. I'm so sad about Lara's passing. Search the house. This whole sequence, Eileen confirmed to me that as someone who hadn't read Catalyst, it still made sense to her and she got it all. But it felt like a bonanza coming out of Catalyst. I'm like, oh yeah, no, this is all straight out of there. This all fits. This is like a mini movie sequel to that book. That was really well done.
Yeah, and also really sets the tone. I mean, right off the bat, you're, you know, killing a mother in front of her daughter. Right off the bat, I'm just like, oh boy, I don't know where this movie is taking me, but I don't think it's to warm and fuzzy places.
It ain't to Disneyland.
Clearly not. No, I don't think it's going to be the Rogue One Galen homestead experience when the Star Wars park opens.
No, it's give me some space. I'm still grieving mountain.
Yeah.
It's just going to be the hug hut. You're just, hey, did you recently watch Star Wars Rogue One? Come in here for a hug. It's Chewbacca and a bunch of Jawas. You can have your pick of your, you know, cuddly Star Wars character to get a relieving hug from. But
okay. So next, I'm a little fuzzy because like I haven't seen it twice. And so, but next I believe she wakes up from that. And well, there's Saw. He shows up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Saw comes and gets her out of the hole, right?
And then she's in jail somewhere.
With the
Is
best
she on Jedha?
She's on Wabi, somewhere else. I think. Okay. It's an anagram for Obi-Wan, whatever the planet is.
Yeah, it was a pretty nondescript planet. We didn't spend a lot of time there. It was just there, serve as
a
prison.
Clone Wars transports being used to carry prisoners around,
which was really cool to see. I thoroughly enjoyed as a mild prequel apologist, not someone who's gonna. I'm not going to try and convince you they're good movies. I'm just there to say I like certain aspects of the prequels. I'll bend over backwards to enjoy watching them. But I really enjoyed a lot of the bridging between 3 and 4 that this movie did. I also loved Jin's roommate in the cell, the snoring Cthulhu-faced monster.
Yes, snoring octopus.
The old one that she shared her prison cell with.
Yes, absolutely. I loved it. It's this hideous thing, and they just treat it as a mild annoyance, like a bad hotel experience.
He always gets shackled with somebody who snores, especially with their Cthulhu. It's awful.
Yeah, absolutely. But then we also get, this is where we get introduced to Cassian, because he's doing some cloak and dagger in the streets of this awesome asteroid city. That establishing shot, I audibly went, oh, in the theater. And sort of my buddy, Ben, sitting right next to me, so I wasn't alone. So this is where he's learning of the defected Imperial pilot, which later on we find out is Bodhi.
Well, and Cassian starts off by being an assassin and killing a guy.
Killing a dude in cold blood.
Welcome to Disney.
Yeah, that caught me more off guard than like the wife murder in the beginning of
That's what the Empire does. We didn't see Aunt Beru get killed, but we know that's what the Empire does. So that's darker because they showed it to us. This is off the charts. Like, we don't see rebels going out just shooting innocent people.
Yeah. Right. In both the Disney and the Star Wars canon, the idea of the quote, good guys having morally ambiguous to basically wrong, you know, murder tactics is huge. It's huge. And I think I give them a lot of credit for sticking to that, because you can bet there were reams of discussions about whether that was staying in the movie. And you could bet they reshot it so that he just like punched him out.
Yeah, I personally really liked this. I mean, because again, if the opening scene didn't really dial it in for you that this is a different type of Star Wars movie, this 100% solidified it, that we are going to more gray areas with the story we're telling here. And I really liked it. I mean, it's something I really enjoyed about the Clone Wars animated series, is it went surprisingly into gray territory, as a matter of fact, with Saw Gerrera, who shows up in this film.
Yeah, and I wondered, I'm still having a hard time reconciling that. I don't like the rebellion being depicted as morally ambiguous. The fun of Star Wars for me as a kid was I knew who the good guys were, and that never changed. It's one thing to have the resistance become a little more gray, because that is an evolved version down the line that is officially disavowed by the Senate, et cetera. Having the roots of the rebellion be in this is trickier for me. I'd accept it easier if it happened 15 years before A New Hope. But as we know, this is months before A New Hope. So it's harder for me to reconcile that Cassian would be allowed to be a rebel in the rebellion that I come to know in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, that's retcon number one.
Yeah. So because I had no real issue whatsoever kind of buying into it. Because I'm like, of course, it's war. This is what happens in war.
Yeah.
Is it strange that I didn't it definitely like surprised me to a great degree.
No, I don't think it's strange, because you're right. You're just looking at it as a war movie.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe because I don't want to like, because I think some of the discussion, some of the pushback against this movie is like the pushback against just darker tone overall, because it's right. been something we've been complaining about with the DC movies now. And still are, even after Suicide Squad, which, you know, brought the fun levels up a decent amount. But I don't want movies to be dark just for the sake of being dark. But I like the dark tone they took with Rogue One, the specific spin they put on it.
It's consistent for me. I think it's consistent with the universe they're trying to create, this other side of it. I don't think they'd ever show Mon Mothma like slicing a guy's neck open, like. They're not going to do that. But yeah, it's realistic to say.
Mothma snuff films.
Yeah. I think it's safe to say that there are elements in any rebellion they saw Guerrero as the leader of a bunch of extremists, right?
Right. So, and they had no problem. Him. So they obviously, yeah. There's obviously a line, and there are people who walked the line. Cassian, maybe he didn't tell anybody that that's what happened, right?
Well, and yeah.
Kept off and running after that point.
And I'm glad you brought up Mon Mothma, Jenny, because it does seem like she's kind of left out of this particular loop, like of these type of measures that they're taking, because it seemed like it was more just Cassian and General Draven that were kind of the core of this, the dark side of the rebellion,
right?
You even see, you know,
and all the toughs that go with them to Scarif.
Yeah. They even explain almost kind of a little too hand wavy, like, yes, these are all the people that should be in jail, but they're here instead.
Look at their beards and icy stares. Of course, you can tell.
We are a team in need of redemption by death. We'll come with you.
Yes.
Okay. So then after that, I just want to get to Jedha. Have we gotten to Jedha yet?
We have not gotten to Jedha yet.
That was incredible.
But that is next, right? Because we learn, once we know about the character of Bodhi, this Imperial cargo pilot who has defected, I'm unclear. Did he go to Jedha? Did he go to Guerrera on purpose? Or is that just who he could get to the easiest?
No, Galen sent him.
Oh, okay, you're right. Oh, that does make sense.
Like,
yeah,
hey, my friend saw... You want to go find him.
So clearly...
Don't worry, he's chill.
Clearly Galen hasn't talked to Saw.
Don't worry, he won't have a giant octopus suck your brain out. I promise.
I was about to say, clearly Galen hadn't checked in with Saw in a while.
Yeah.
Because Saw's...
Saw changed, Galen.
Yeah. Saw's straight up nuts.
So... Yeah, so I don't remember the order of anything. You just tell me when I'm supposed to talk about something, and I'll talk about
we'll
it.
We'll do. Right now, we're on a Bodhi's meeting with Saw. This is the first time we see the moon of Jedha. which I have to keep reminding myself.
Can we talk about that for a second? Because that planet was so awesome. There was a Jedi, like one of those great Lord of the Rings statues that like has crumbled into the earth.
Right, where Samwise and Frodo boated down before the river dried up.
Yeah, they have these amazing like Jedis in the sand, that incredible rock planet. Like, and also it's called Jedha, which I would assume, like, it's not the first Jedi temple or anything, but like one is either named after the other. Like, that can't be a coincidence. It was.
Yeah, the Jedi may have arisen on Jedha in this new universe.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't answer the question of the first Jedi temple, though, which I would like to save for later, but yeah.
Oh my God, the set pieces on this planet or moon. You're absolutely right, Jenny.
Yeah, it was just stunning.
It was driving my fandom up to like 11. Like the fan service kind of like Blue Milk and butt face from Mos Eisley. Like I was like, okay, we didn't need that. But like this type of stuff, this is where I really am like, thank you. Thank you for
the doctor. I liked their spinoff on ABC in the 80s.
I can't remember the name.
But this is a good time to give a shout out to this movie for what I think is some of the best world building and building convincing worlds too. Because look, I will give the prequels this. They built the hell out of these worlds, but they felt flat in the way that the technology was rendering it at the time. Mm-hmm. And they felt like sort of cartoony. I think Coruscant was probably the best realized world in the prequels. Man, did they build out in very little time depth and complexity and ecosystems and economies within just these brief glimpses of the worlds that you were seeing in Rogue One. And I give major props to that.
Just a real quick shout out to Star Wars Complete Locations, a canon reference book reissued this year on September 27th, which notes that Jedha is argued to be the origin city of the Jedi, along with some scholars arguing, no, it was Coruscant, et cetera, et cetera. So it is in canon under dispute whether this is actually the origin of the first temple, because it's also Octo, Ossus, and Tython that are other candidate worlds.
Okay.
That is
good notes.
I heard about that, but so, because didn't that come out right after Force Awakens, and now it's out again with like addendums or?
Well, it came out September 27th. I don't know if that, I don't remember whether it came out right after Force Awakens. It came out in 2005. And then they have now reissued it to canonize it.
Okay. Hmm. Gotcha. Yeah. Because that's also where I believe all of the information about Vader's castle came from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which we'll talk about.
We'll get to that at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Orthanc?
Which is great. Yeah. So, all right. So, Garrett, fill us in. I can't. I have to see things like twice for me to know.
It's totally fine.
Is Wikipedia updated? Hold on. I'll go to Wikipedia.
It is. That's what I'm drawing from at this very moment. Although I believe Wikipedia skips over the Vader castle scene entirely. But
well,
other than that,
good for them.
Good for
quality
them.
Move.
So this is where we see Jedha for the first time, and then at this point all of the characters are heading that way. I mean, Jin is brought to the rebel base on Yavin, and she's broken out by the rebels. We meet K2SO, tying for my favorite character
awesome.
Of the film. And then she's taken to Yavin base, and they explain why they broke her out, which is her connection to Saw Gerrera, because they know he has Bodhi. So they want to use her as to just broker a meeting with Saw, basically.
Right. Can I just who hit their significant other on the arm multiple times when they saw Yavin 4? I did.
Oh yeah, no, both of us have bruises. Absolutely.
Yeah. It was just like, oh my god, it's Yavin! Ah!
And well, especially when you see the guy.
Yes,
in the
guy at the tower. That was the moment that I knew exactly the timeline of this movie. Like, I had no doubt, and I was like, I know where it's going to end. Like, that's when I knew some way it was going to end with the Tanta 4. I just knew it. Like, that was my click-in moment.
For me,
striking from their hidden rebel base. We were watching them strike from their hidden rebel base.
Yeah.
See, I was just kind of like, yeah, of course it's in this movie. Like, I didn't get excited or anything, because I was just like, at this point, and it kind of snowballed, like, because then when Tarkin showed up, I was like, yes, of course he's here. He has to be.
Honestly, the part that I think I got the most fanny, and then the other part of my brain that was suppressed at the time was like, okay, that's kind of dumb. But I was so fan excited to see whatever Grass Valley Avid switcher they had around in 1977 that served as the control unit, that later on in life I'm like, wow, that's so cheap. It's just a switcher. It's like a TV switcher. And they're like, oh, yeah, no, we're still using that in this movie. Like, that is how the Death Star was
on the Death Star. Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Yeah, and I just love the commitment. And this is where this movie went right, where I think the prequels, like, tried too hard to be a little too sassy, but like, they committed to the 70s look in this movie. Like, they committed to being in the exact moment. Every actor looked like they were from the 70s. Every piece of clothing, like, they just went for it. And that made me so happy, because just because a movie is made 30 something years after the one it immediately precedes, like, thank you for having visual consistency here. It made my day. Except for that castle on Mustafar. I don't think that belonged. I have a feeling that castle is about to be our new Snap Wexley, but anyway.
I see you.
Okay, so now that I have my Wikipedia up, I kind of want to talk about Churrut Imwe and Baze Malbus, because those two are awesome.
Yeah, let's just talk. Let's have our big just kind of Jedha word explosion, because after Yavin, Jin is sent with Cassian and K2 to Jedha to meet with Saw and to get Bodhi, and the market scene. My God. First of all, the city, like, it's built up, and that was even in the trailer, and I did not notice in the trailer that it was like a Jedi temple, because we get to see the entrance of it with the big monolithic Jedi statues carved into this cliff face, and I just, damn it, I love it. I love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you
building, like, of the world,
and then the world, they're even like invoking the word Kyber crystals in now a canon live action big budget Star Wars movie, which never happened before. Like you said,
yep. Guardian of the Wills shows up.
Oh, good God. Yeah.
Alluding to the Journal of the Wills, the first draft of Star Wars by Lucas, alluding to the Force of Others, which was in that first draft instead of the Force, as if like, well, that's the more ancient way that you would say it. And it's persisted here because this is one of the first temples.
Do you think that somewhere in his giant screening room on Lucas Valley Road, George Lucas watched this movie and was like, yes, like, finally, they put my stuff in the movie. Like,
he was probably like, I edited that out for a reason. I wouldn't have used that.
Be
nice to George. We wouldn't have this set, George. Be nice to George. Leave him alone.
No, I know. It was a good moment. You know what it was? It was a flag to me that these movies are going to, in 10 years maybe, get to a level of complexity that, say, like Doctor Strange is now in the Marvel world. Like, if you set up Kyber crystals and Guardian of the Wills, you are willing to go all the way back perhaps to, like, really the Old Republic at the beginning, or even before that. And I may not be alive to see it, but it's gonna be a great movie. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how much did you see this at, like, Jenny, you're the big Extended Universe nut on the show.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of pushback from EU fans. I am not one of them, so it's lost on me completely. Mm-hmm. How did all this land on you? Do you see it as weird sideways fan service, or do you see it as an attempt to respect the mythos of Star Wars?
I'm 100% into it. It seems to me like they are saying very clearly in this movie, no, we're not going to bring everything in wholesale, because frankly, that extended universe became like a disastrous contractual mess of not quite interlocking storylines. But we recognize all the good storytelling that was done in the best of it, and we will poach that like we will poach anything else. And I think that's great. I'm like, great. There are things I would really like to see, and I'm not just saying this because I think someday I'll get a Mara Jade movie. That's fine. But I do think that that it says we'll take good story from anywhere. And that was a very specific nod.
By the way, do you think Jyn Erso had a baby sometime before this movie started?
I know. I was thinking about that. I was like,
man, she just, you know, she runs around.
She had to leave the kid with a giant string thing. No, it wouldn't have worked. There's no way. There's no way it would have. The time does not work.
I like
she could have had one before this beginning of this movie and left it with someone because she just can't. She's not responsible.
But that could not be a baby that we saw running around.
Oh, no, not the one in Jeddah. You're right. No, that's not what I meant. I meant just okay. Somewhere else. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But that could be why she is so pulled to save it. I mean, it works well enough to be like, oh, I used to be a kid that was left alone and I don't want this child. You know, I want to protect this child. But it could also be something else. I don't know.
Well, you'll have to do the math for me because my brain can't comprehend. But,
I'm not trying to say that kid was her baby, but her going, I have a baby that I haven't really taken care of. I'm going to save this baby.
Man, right. But
if we're implying who that baby is going to be.
Or that baby could be somebody's parents. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
I thought it was just the movie showing us that she's a better person than Cassian.
It's the pet the dog moment.
Yeah. That's probably all.
I did not read into that at all, like whatsoever. I'm like, oh, cool. She's a good person. Yeah, move on. but
okay.
Everything.
I'm not trying to say she's Ray's mom.
That's what I was getting at.
I thought this movie took like it almost felt like the reshoots were just because they started reading the two most popular theories. One, that she's Rey's mom, and two, that they become the Knights of Ren. And they're like, you know what? By the end of this, we want to say absolutely unequivocally no. Capital N-O. You're wrong.
I'm just forcing that door back open. I know. I'm a horrible person.
Okay, so wait—is there anything else on Jeddah we should talk about?
I mean, we should talk about the meeting with the Guardians.
Yeah.
Which I need to pull up the names of because they almost never say their names in the movie. So it's Baze and it's Chirrut.
Chirrut. Imwe.
Chirrut Imwe.
Imwe.
Oh yeah, I love these guys so much. Oh. It's hard to put into a cohesive sentence how much I enjoyed these characters. And I was so skeptical from the trailers. I'm like, yeah, we've got like the blind monk with the bow staff and I'm so on board now after this movie.
Here's one thing. And I'm going to take upon myself to be the role of pot shotter here, even though I love the movie.
Do it.
If he had a thing that shoots laser bolts, why wasn't he using it on Jeddah? Because later on he's shooting things down at the engineering place.
He
want to laser people in his hometown.
You don't laser where you live. It's just that old principle.
He was using it from behind cover, from a control position. Mm-hmm. Whereas here he was on the open just doing his beggar thing.
Yeah.
Right. I think, and one note I'll make, and I don't have a problem with this, is that if you really think about it, the character of Chirrut and the character of K2SO are similar archetypes, which is we say anything we think out loud, despite that being appropriate. And it's
and sometimes
a big
over and over and over, over and over and over and over again.
Right. And so, right. The force is with me. I'm one with the force.
Okay. I got it.
Say it with your mouth closed. But I think that I'm okay with it, but I will just note, like, if I were a writer, I would have definitely gotten a note that was like, these two have a very similar core archetype, and how are we going to distinguish them? So, anyway, minor note.
Okay. I didn't pick that up as much with Chirrut, but I see what you're getting at.
Social, I don't know where I'm going with this, but, like, a certain lack of caring about social politeness in any form.
Mm. Right, because he's a mystic. Extent.
Yeah.
Right? And that's one of the things I love about this is it's kind of hard sometimes to reconcile myself with the idea that Darth Vader was Anakin Skywalker, a member of a thriving Jedi community, and that somehow in the intervening years, the Jedi have become extinct and not, you know, and nobody believes in them anymore. And this kind of showed me how that would happen.
Right.
Is that you would have people like Chirrut Imwe out there who are trying to carry on the legacy of the dead Jedi, but obviously, you know, they're pretty good, but they're not Jedi. Right. And they get destroyed in this movie, which leads to Tarkin telling Vader, you are the last, you know, your Jedi religion, you are the last of their kind. Like, I just killed the last remnants at Jeddah, like a little while ago. So it kind of ties that up a little better. And I'm like, okay, I can see where the wiping out of the Jedi, even though people remember when they were around, is now like, oh yeah, but they died. So they obviously weren't that powerful. And where are they now? Are there any more? No, nowhere. You know, their temples get destroyed. The Empire's wiping them off the map.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, too, anyone who was sympathetic to the Jedi's cause to a degree that they would actually be outspoken about it would be crushed under the heel of the Empire.
Yeah.
Which we saw pretty much in this movie. The only ones that are still walking around are people like Chirrut who are effectively relegated to being homeless.
Can we talk about the hologram? I want to talk about the hologram.
The hologram from Galen?
Yeah.
The hologram from Galen? Yeah. Okay, so fast forward to the meeting with Saw and whatnot. And the message that Bodhi carried with him was a holo from Galen, Jin's father. What would you like to say about the holo, Jenny?
Well, it's very important. Yeah, holo, Jen. There's very important information in it, which leads to the number one retcon of all time. So I just wanted to get us to the number one retcon of all time.
Yep. How do we feel about Rogue One taking it upon itself to make the vulnerability of the first Death Star all part of the plan?
Totally into it.
I don't know that I consider it a retcon, right? It was always just an open question of like, well, how did they discover this? And the idea was they got the plans and looked them over and found a little oversight. And that has been the butt of numerous jokes. My favorite is the animation of the engineers of the Death Star kind of going over how this could have possibly happened. And now we know it's like, oh, the engineers weren't incompetent. It was a backdoor. Yeah, it was a sabotage effort. He made the reactor core vulnerable, but couldn't leave it obvious how to attack it, or else someone would notice. So he had to leave it up to you to look at the plans to figure out how to get something into the reactor core, but it was there for you to find. So it matches up nicely. I think it matches up really elegantly to not undermining anything I thought, but saying, oh, and that's why if you found a thermal exhaust port, you could get a missile in. This is why it would blow it up. Because that was always my big question.
Yeah, I liked it as well. And I also liked the emphasis put on the rebellion not trusting Galen. Because it also, in my head, made it make sense that they would not even mention him in A New Hope when they're explaining how to blow it up. Because there's probably plenty of people who still, even after everything that happened on Scarif, didn't believe that Galen was still loyal to the cause.
Or knew about what happened on Scarif.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, who would have known that a bunch of shit, like, well, you know, it's like early stages of chaos of war. Like, you know, if Princess Leia never mentioned it, like, she probably didn't even know what was going on the surface there.
Oh, I'm like, sure, like,
you're not getting reports, you know, we're jumping ahead.
I'm sure, like, General Dodonna knows, though. I mean, we saw him in this movie hanging out next to, I'm sure he was very aware, but.
Right. So it's interesting. One thing I love about Star Wars is, like, how information doesn't travel well in that universe. And I think about it a lot, actually, in terms of communication and, like, getting information out and things that are just lost to history. Like,
a lot of
you know that Jyn Erso ever existed if you were living on Coruscant?
Probably not.
Because this is a pretty, it's a galaxy. We think about it as a solar system, I think, sometimes in our heads, but it's
Force Awakens didn't help with
thousands
that.
And thousands of solar systems, if not more. So, yeah. Sure, that makes Starkiller Base a little harder to swallow, but okay. Yeah. Leave that aside.
When Honest Trailers comes out, when the DVD for this is released, I have a prediction for the Honest Trailer, which is they're basically going to say, oh, wait, I'm sorry. Are you telling me that we have faster than light travel, droids that have sentient intelligence, any number of other things, including lightsabers and a Death Star, but we couldn't compress the Death Star design plans onto a flash drive? Is that what you're telling me?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I don't even want to get into that till we get to that part. Cause I have so many things to say about all of that.
Oh geez.
Him telling her, this is the kickoff of the whole rest of the movie. And as one of my husband's writer friends used to say, it might be based on a faulty premise, but anyway, there are lots of faulty premises in movies, and we're not gonna meddle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever.
So,
it's a fantasy.
A fantasy.
Physics on, works Jenny. Different in that galaxy.
Data is hard to compress in that galaxy, but spaceships aren't.
No, nope.
Right.
Not at all. So then I think we need to talk about the first scene with Tarkin / Krennic on the Death Star, because it happens shortly after the scene where Jyn is seeing the Hollow, because we get to see Krennic and Tarkin kind of sparring. Like you said, Tom, we get to see this power struggle.
I like to call him Tarkin-esque. Tarkin-ish.
Yeah.
This is a weird one for me, because I don't know if I would just forgot or got wiped out of my head, but when I was watching it the first time around, I thought they had just recast someone. And I was like, oh, he looks close enough to him. And I bought it. And it was fine.
Really?
I'm like, his skin tone's a little darker. And then afterwards, Eileen's like, no, that was CGI. I'm like, oh, right. I forgot. So it was good enough to make me forget, but it wasn't good enough to make me think it was, in fact, Peter Cushing, which it was. And on the second viewing, could see, like, oh, okay, the eyes don't move a little bit right way. And the skin tone difference probably is because of the processing.
And less cheekbones. Like, Peter Cushing, the actor, had, I think, an irreplicable face with those high, gaunt cheekbones and bearing. And I think not enough time passed between Rogue One and Star Wars A New Hope for him to have changed that dramatically. Like, there was a difference, but it was still pretty well done. And I think really, like, that moment for me when I saw Grand Moff Tarkin, I was like, in some ways, this is the redemption of the idea of Jar Jar Binks. No one will ever redeem that character for me. But
told you Jar Jar Binks was in it.
Yeah. No, but the concept that George Lucas wanted to do, which is what Gollum Schmeagle did the first time very well, is finally, I think, in some ways redeemed in this movie from a technical standpoint.
All right. Now I'm going to pick the nits, because this was the single biggest thing that bothered me the most in this movie. It looked extreme. And this isn't me like trying to win an argument and say like, you guys are wrong. I'm honestly fascinated, Tom, that you bought it as much as you did, because it looked so fake to me from the very first shot. And I was like, no, like the second he turned around, I'm like, God damn it. No, why'd you do this? Because the scenes are great. And the story they're telling between these two characters, I think, needed to be told. And it's something that we see a lot in the novels right now. I mean, Tarkin is a presence in a lot of the new novels that are coming out. And I love everything they're doing with him in the novels. I love what they're doing with him and what they did with him in Clone Wars, what they're doing with him in Rebels. But I just get Charles Dance. Like, good God.
Yeah.
Just recast him.
That's a fair point.
Just get an actor that kind of looks like him, but you know can do the role. Because the whole time I'm looking at him, I'm just like, this is impressive, but it's not. It's wrong. There's just...
So what you're saying, Garrett, is I'm far too trusting.
No, I'm
thinking my neat glasses though.
I legitimately wish I had that reaction, because I feel like if I just bought it and kind of just was like, yeah, cool, let's do this, I would have just been head over heels in love with this movie. And as it is, I really, really enjoyed this film. But man, every scene with Tarkin, all I was doing was just like, the semi-translucency on the skin is just not there. It's not right. That's not what humans look like.
And one thing that I will say is, like, they did two different choices within the same movie. They made digital characters out of two critical characters, and yet they also recast a bunch of roles, like Mon Mothma. So I think it was, for me,
Mon Mothma is the same Mon Mothma from the prequels, no?
From the prequels, yes. Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah,
so I'm just saying, like, obviously from the original actress. So the choice to split off your paradigm for what you're going to do with characters where the actor is no longer present or not age appropriate is, like, that caused me some, like, tiny cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I think Charles Dance would have been better than Paper Tarkin. But
yeah, I don't want to crapple over Guy Henry's performance as Tarkin, because I thought he did a very good job. And they could have just put him in makeup. He doesn't look that off. So I don't know.
There is a probably a buyer's market on old British guys with high cheekbones. And I think they could have, like, you know, look for one. But I respect their fidelity in that way.
Yeah, you can get them duty free at Heathrow right now.
Absolutely. I mean, the way that the pound is right now, you could get them for pretty cheap.
There's so much I know we want to talk about here, but that, maybe not today, but maybe in the next episode. I think there's a discussion to be had about dead actors and reusing their likenesses in scenes that they never acted. I find that dirty in a weird way.
Oh yeah. I've read a couple articles about just the ethics of doing that at all. The estate of Peter Cushing was thanked at the end of this movie and apparently cooperated with this the whole way through. So I feel like no matter what you think of the execution of it, it sounds like they went about it the right way and said, can we use the likeness? Do we have your cooperation with it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like fruitful discussion for next month's podcast.
Yeah. That's why I was like, it's still there.
Much of a movie to get there.
Yes, absolutely. I just want everyone listening who's about to send in 15 emails about the ethics of that. I want you to know it's floating around in the back of my head, but it's not why we met to talk today.
Yeah.
So, anyways, yeah. So once if I can just get past that, I loved everything with Tarkin, and I'm so glad he was as big of a presence in this movie as he was. I thought we were going to get more Vader and less Tarkin, and we got way more Tarkin than Vader.
And I'm glad.
I am too.
You know, CGI aside, plot wise, that makes more sense to me.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No. Absolutely. It really does, and that's why.
Because this was a war movie, not a Jedi movie.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's why I'm putting my emphasis on my kind of unhappiness just on the CG. Really, at the end of the day, that's the thing that kind of irked me. Because I've seen a lot of pushback just in general. Like, oh, you had to put this in as fan service. I'm like, no, it's not fan service. It's writing a script with the Death Star involved. There's no way he's not going to be there.
So then we get the big moment, right? When they're in Jedha, right? And they when they blow it up, which I like to call the 2012 outrunning the earthen wall of flame moment.
It reminded me of
they outrun it just in time.
Although I will give them points for having them have to run towards it to get away from it.
Yes.
Instead of having it just be like, we can outrun the wind. Like,
right.
That made more sense to me somehow.
Yeah,
it's like
it felt real.
It's like when you're at the beach and a big wave comes, just dive under it.
And you guys have a better sense of this than me, but how did you feel about the ending of Saw Gerrera?
I don't understand why he didn't give her the message. I understand him saying, I've lived too long. There's hardly any of me left. You're the hope of the rebellion, and the hope is right here. Hey, wait, don't forget the hope. I've got it. Like, seriously? Maybe he's just so old he forgot. I don't know.
Honest trailers will handle this in six months.
I mean, the whole base was kind of falling apart, like mid-hollow message. So I get it to some point.
I get Jin being all, she's distraught, and the captain, Cassian, doesn't know it's there. But I guess Saw is just crazy. We've seen that. Like, he doesn't. He's off his rocker at this point.
I mean, and also like again, an A-bomb is going off down the street. Like, I buy it to a certain degree.
Sure.
Yeah, it's convenient timing for the plot, for sure.
Put your data in the cloud, though. Like, couldn't they have streamed it to the ship? Again, we come back to information management in the Star Wars galaxy.
That's not how it works in Star Wars.
Really...
it's just bad backup policies, you know?
Yeah.
You should always have three copies of your data at any time, and they weren't following that. This is what you get.
I feel like Crash Plan is very cheap on planets like that, and they should really have taken advantage of it.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Are we halfway through the movie yet or not so much?
I would say we're at the halfway point.
Okay.
Let's say we're at the halfway point.
We have seen the power of this Death Station at least two, right? We've got two level power of the Death Star.
Also, seeing the Death Star, what I believe all of us within the Star Wars community would refer to as hanging upside down, really cool. Because of course it can. It's in space.
Yeah. Yeah,
direction is
not really upside down.
Yeah, direction
just
is relative.
Showed up in the best position to shoot.
Yeah, direction is relative. I loved that. But then we get the scene at the Imperial Science Facility, where Jin goes to find her father
Edu.
On Edu. I loved this as well. These are the kind of things, these are the kind of locales you only get to see in like extended stuff like Clone Wars, for example. And I'd love that we were like, yeah, we're going to where the Imperial scientists hang out. And I was so into that. And then
a bunch of old white guys with beards building stuff. They don't know what it is.
Yeah. Then there's the whole sub,
like Los Alamos.
There's a whole, the whole subplot of Cassian was ordered to kill Galen, not extract him.
Yep, that worked for me. Yep.
I'm still bugged by like, really? The rebellion would just order him assassinated. We're ordering assassinations now in the rebellion.
I buy it, like, because
well, part of it.
I buy it because of the opening scene with Cassian.
Yeah, yeah, it's consistent. I'll give you that.
And again, I think it was just Cassian and a small handful of people in the rebellion, because it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't Mon Mothma. It wasn't the general.
If you accept that, everything on Edu makes sense for me, and it's all well executed, and we get the beautiful, touching death scene of Galen Erso and his daughter Jyn seeing each other for the first time in a decade or more. But I was really confused about the ship, because K2SO says, if Cassian comes out back here before them, I'm leaving. I'm like, leaving in what? Your ship's crashed. He said you need another ship. And then at one point, K2SO and the pilot are talking about taking off. And I'm like, wait, which ship are they in? Did they get down to the Empire shuttle? Like, I saw it twice, and I was still kind of confused about how people got from one ship to the other. And I know they crashed one ship, left in an Empire ship, and that's really all you need to be concerned with. But that was muddled for me.
I was spatially confused on Edu, because I thought they were very far away from the base, and yet everybody seemed to get there like really easily. But I thought they were in this cavernous gulf between the faraway platform and where Cassian was to shoot. And I was kind of like, guys, it looked really hard for Jyn. Did you guys just like super fly over? Like, how'd you do? Like, so spatially, Edu is probably one of the places where it wasn't perfectly clear what was going on.
It's the effect of all those kyber crystals.
For sure. Absolutely.
The sense of time seemed distorted. And to you, Tom, I was 100% just as confused as you were in regards to the ship. It feels like there's a deleted scene or something where they procure
laser
the
sniper in our chat just said exactly that. It's like totally a deleted scene explains that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But I love the science team logo. It's so 70s. Like the second they showed up with their white coats, and then just that really kind of cheesy, big, bold, like octagonal logo. I'm like, yes, I buy that 100%.
Too. It's very Lostian, like a bunch of old guys totally cut off from their
this is what the science hatch.
Exactly. Exactly. It was like totally consistent. Made me laugh.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. But then I love that Cassian finally makes a choice, you know, not to kill Galen. I like that we see, I bought into that character development, that, you know, he's become friends with Jyn, or at least has some sort of, you know, fondness for her. So, okay, maybe I won't murder your father in cold blood. But then I love that he still dies, and it's because of collateral damage from a rebel attack and not from the Imperials.
Friendly fire.
Yeah.
Well, even though they don't know. They don't know, but it's like, it's messy.
But they knew. Like, the original attack by the rebels was ordered because they want to make sure Galen's dead.
Right, but it's not like the pilot.
What they didn't know was that the others were there and they should call it off, and they were endangering Jyn. They never cared about saving Galen's life, though.
Right.
I don't think they cared so much about Jyn either. She was just the key to open the door. So I think, and again, that's very consistent with this as being like a morally ambiguous war movie that says, okay, well, yes, the Empire is bad. They destroyed an entire planet and many other things, but you're not dealing with perfect absolutes on the other side. And to me, I like that.
That said,
because only the Sith deal in absolutes.
When General Draven did find out that they were there, he did try to call it off, but they could.
Because of Cassian.
Right.
With the communications issues. I'm sorry. Can you not contact your ship when they're attacking people?
Oh, they've already begun their attack run.
Sorry, guys.
I mean,
you know what?
It's rude to tell an attacking X-Wing to stop. Like,
if
that's
Base could talk to Maverick and Goose, like, they can talk to these guys. Like, come on.
Personally, I in that case, I just find it annoying that they're giving orders from a base on another planet and not from, you know, something orbiting closer, so that they have a clear lines of communication. Right. Now you've pulled me rebels into the same thing. Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Yeah. I think this rebel, the base, really needs to work on their inter-party communication skills.
They need to go find their BB unit and unbend its antenna.
That's right. Okay, so everybody leaves Edu. We're off to the next planet. Everybody's sad. And then they go back, right? Don't they go back to Yavin? And,
they do.
And there's like a big, yet again, a big...
Well, this is where we get to see Orthanc first.
Yeah. Sorry. Right.
And then then we go back to Yavin for Jin to say, hey, everybody, we figured out how to destroy the Death Star. And everybody's like, great, we're the Rebellion. In every other movie we've ever done, all someone like Luke Skywalker has to say is, I know a thing and we trust them implicitly and execute on it. Except not this man.
Not this girl. Yeah. Can we talk about Orthanc for a second? Because I found that unconvincing.
Their inability
would build that big tower?
I mean, do you have to be on Mustafar, dude? Like,
I buy Mustafar
as well.
Because that is where Darth Vader was born.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He was christened in Coruscant, but he was born in the fires of the volcano. Like, that's when he truly became who he was to become. So I can see him wanting to have his base there, for sure.
That's very moody, dramatic Anakin, I guess.
Yeah,
so
and it's where he last saw Padme.
Right. Right. So he's just constantly gazing out at the lava strewn mm-hmm. destruction and thinking about his mistakes. Right.
Okay, Jenny, I agree with you. I think the movie failed to sell us on it. I think the movie failed to sell us on it. All of the explanation that's taking place outside of it, like in the Complete Locations book again, mm-hmm. really helps, like, saves it for me. But I wish that had been in the film. I wish the film had explained a little more, you know, what exactly the whole point of this place was. I don't want to invoke incorrect
That's
sources.
A tricky line though, right? Because this isn't a saga.
Yeah. But so I think it's in
you
the,
start getting into saga territory if you have to explain as a standalone movie. The big, dark, black-helmeted guy lives in a big black tower on a volcano planet. Makes perfect sense. We're like, oh, yeah, well, that's where a big black,
evil,
dark...
Was it a black tower? I thought it was a white tower, which I thought was really
it was black.
Weird.
No, it was black. Very all right. Black.
All right. Next viewing.
There was a couple easy things. I think, you know, when Krennic disembarks for there, it could have been simple to have a scene where he's entering the shuttle and be, you know, set a course for Mustafar. So we know, we didn't know. And
they did the unusual thing of giving us titles of planets.
Mm-hmm. Of every
constantly.
Planet.
Like,
except
why not
that,
not that one.
One?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it would have made sense. Or in the distance, have that same, like, mining facility that he fought Obi-Wan on.
Broken down.
I was looking for it. The second we saw lava, I'm like, oh, are we on Mustafar? Are we on Mustafar? Okay, oh, super cool castle. And then I'm looking in the background for one of those large installations.
Built the
nothing.
Castle out of the remains of the factory.
I feel fairly certain this shows us how scared Disney people are of the prequels. Because
yes.
they broke their established rule of establishing locations. They didn't give you any continuity to the prequel. They were just like, nope, not going to do it. Not even going to invoke it in this first movie that is not a saga movie.
Not that I want to see torture, but give me one Jedi in the background being tortured. Because I guess that is also mentioned in Complete Locations, is that this is a place where they brought the surviving Jedi to torture and break them. To find out. And there's also mention of the Emperor shows up and they meditate on the dark side together in this location because of its significance of the creation of Darth Vader. And I'm like, yes, that, all of it. I am into all of that. None of that was in the movie. None of it. I'm just like...
You want to see like the outline of a Togruta female hanging by her chains in the background.
Oh. No, I don't. I don't want to see that. I want to see a live action Ahsoka movie.
We're going back to Yavin.
Okay, cool. Yeah, no, okay, but real quick. Everyone's angry about Darth Vader pun. Are you angry about Darth Vader pun?
Yeah. Well, two minds. One, yes, absolutely. Two, we are still in the last period before it becomes Darth Vader of New Hope, and he's still got a little Anakin in there, and Anakin was a really crappy punster, joker, thought he was more funny than he was type of guy. So in some ways I could see them trying to make the link that there's still a human being named Anakin Skywalker coming to grips with his new, like, you know, clanky body and still trying to be a human under there. Mm-hmm. But it is sort of a big, like, And that's in some senses, that's also private Darth Vader. He's not publicly walking through a spaceship, like choking people to death, or and it's like him and one other guy.
He's playing so with this underling.
The continuity link, but it didn't work for me.
Yeah. See, I actually kind of liked it because
I thought it was hilarious.
For two reasons. One, it reminded me of apology accepted, Captain Nita. Like that, he's clearly being playful in an extremely morbid way in that scene in Empire. And this is the same thing. It's just a pun, and whatever. I don't care that it's a pun. I kind of giggled, and I'm like, yeah, Vader takes pleasure in choking people out. He does it in public in a meeting on the original Death Star. I find your lack of faith disturbing. And he cracks jokes while murdering a captain. So I thought it was perfectly fine.
I mean, Jenny, I totally thought of the same things regarding, like, he's still becoming Darth Vader, and there's still a little Anakin. And I think we see that in the lightsaber battle scene later on as well. And it makes sense if you think about it. Like, the Darth Vader we see in A New Hope is just small glimpses of who he's going to become in Empire. In Empire, he has fully become Darth Vader.
Yeah, and also, like, in this movie and in A New Hope, it's kind of Vader at in the best mood I think we'll ever find him, right? Because he, like, in Empire and Return, he's on the back foot. Things are not going well for the Empire, and he's grasping at straws.
He found out his son's alive, and the Death Star got blown up on his watch, and he got shot down. I mean, not a good week.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And in Rogue One, this is the pinnacle of the Empire. No one questions them. They have absolute power, and Darth Vader is second only to one.
So, but here it's still being established.
Right.
So that's fair.
Yeah.
And one other thing I'll say is maybe it wasn't that he was being jokey. It was that the quality of the pun was not as good as apology accepted, Captain Nita. Like, that's dry.
That's dry, not a pun.
That's dry humor and not a pun. And I think as someone married to a comedian, that makes all the difference, is that it is consistent, horrible, morbid humor. So, minor point. It was still great to see Darth Vader.
Yeah. To me, the bigger failing was, like, not really doing anything with that location. Like, that scene could have taken place on a Star Destroyer.
Back to Tank.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, Back to Tank was really cool. I'm
that's
sad
the only
we
place
didn't
he feels safe taking off the armor.
I'm sad we didn't see more of that really grotesque model, honestly.
Yeah, and for one second I thought we were going to see Hayden Christensen.
And actually, am I the only person on Earth that was disappointed we didn't get that? Because the second it was confirmed that, yes, this is Vader, and I'm like, I hope this entire meeting with Krennic is with this disgusting mucusy corpse in a tube. I want that.
No, that's weakness.
Oh, I want that. Weakness.
Yeah, you got to show up with your armor.
No, I want it. I wanted.
Honestly, if they'd used Christensen's face, I personally could never. With the hair gone, I wouldn't have really been able to be like, oh yeah, that's definitely him. Yeah. So
I would have liked it, because I would have liked Krennic to take it as a sign of weakness and overstep, and then him to choke his ass through the back to tank.
Right, because he doesn't need to do that. That's just for fun.
Yeah,
with his hands.
and pull him up to the glass and move him up the tube and go eye to eye with him. Like, I would have loved something like that.
That would be super powerful if Krennic. That's a really good. I didn't even think about that. If, like, he could use the Force to beat up Krennic without leaving the back to tank. Whoa,
that's what I wanted. And, like, the glass to crack a little bit. And Vader's my favorite villain of all time, so I was really hoping to see a different, like, monster level Vader. But whatever, I'll take him, you know, kind of. We got James Earl Jones, you know, more lines as Vader. That's all I needed. I'm happy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Please record all phonemes of James Earl Jones while we still can.
Yeah. But I'm with this. Overall, this entire scene was one of my least favorite parts in the film. I'm with you, Jenny, on that. But I'll defend the castles because I won't defend the way they use it in the movie. Anyways, moving on. So
back to Yavin.
So we already kind of talked about the rebels not believing Jin, and I get that to a certain degree. I also get the criticism of, like, some farm boys, like, well, that's no bigger than a womp rat, yada yada yada. Okay, cool, go with his plan.
Oh, Red 5 just died on the Scarif run, you get to be Red 5 now.
I liked that nod personally. I liked that a lot.
That was subtle continuity. And also the guy, are we there yet? We're not there yet. So they get the
This is the pep talk. This is Jen saying, we should all just do this to fight the Empire. And we get a Republic era Senate debate rather than a New Hope era or Empire era Senate debate, which is like, I don't know. I think they're too powerful. We should just all scatter and give up.
Yeah. And then, before we leave Yavin, one of my favorite parts of the movie, which is setting up that Princess Leia is going to go get Obi-Wan Kenobi just by like subtle inference between Mon Mothma and Bail Organa. Like, I thought there was not enough Bail Organa in this movie, and I kind of wish there had been more.
I was really happy to see Jimmy Smith show up in this, to be completely honest.
Yeah, for sure. Me too.
I think he's a good actor. I thought he did well with what he had in the prequels, and I liked the way they used the character of Bail Organa in the Clone Wars, so I was happy to see that here.
And I'm happier with them underusing Bail Organa than overusing him. Mm. So, I mean, I was with you, Jenny. I could have used a little more Bail Organa, but it could have easily become too much. So
yeah.
I'm glad they aired on that side, I think.
And also, it was the coolest line ever, which I don't have committed to memory, but I have an old friend from the Clone Wars who might be able to help. That was pretty great.
Yeah, I dug it. That was
Ben hiding would have been a great second line.
Oh man, I almost did a Gatorade spit take. Holy cow, that was well timed.
I cannot believe he's still alive.
You keep doing it.
Stop it, Tom. Jenny, stop drinking Gatorade too.
Obi-Wan with the Force.
It's the only beverage in this office. I'm like dying. We've been going for an hour and a half. We haven't got through the movie. Okay. So they get off. They all take off in a rebellious moment with their crew of Suicide Squatters.
This movie was to
the planet. What was it called?
Scarif.
Scarif, right. They get to Scarif that has just one little chink in the armor. They get through, and then it's Firefly.
You're right.
I mean, kind of, right?
That's not that's one of our listeners.
Don't want to spoil Serenity too much, but I've definitely seen that parallel drawn out fairly compellingly.
Yeah, one of our listeners sent that in, which we'll get to in a second. But yeah, it's Firefly.
First off, if you haven't seen Firefly and Serenity by now, you've had over a decade.
Yeah, you had all your time.
you've had all the time in the world. And secondly, most of them survived the events of Serenity. So I'm not sure how much I buy into that comparison.
All right. I'm going to jump through a few things here because this is another problem. And again, I keep bringing up these problems because they exist and I think about them. None of them reduced my enjoyment the first time through. Hmm. And most of them didn't even reduce my enjoyment the second time through, although they may be contributing factors to that fatigue of I don't need to see it again. But there's a big issue besides the obvious one we've been alluding to about data compression, which is they can't get the data out once the shield gate gets closed, and they can't because they can't get off the ground. So they need to turn on a relay to be able to send the data out to send a message out from the ship on the ground, because somehow a message can get through the shield gate, but not the data. That's confusing. Right? Like, if I do the relay, then I can send a message to them to tell them to blow up the shield gate. But I can't actually send the file out, maybe because it's too big.
Maybe it's, again, like you can get a text message out in an earthquake, but not a...
Right. Maybe it's that.
Yeah.
They're probably going to try to bring the shield gate down anyway, because that's the whole point of the battle, is to protect the people on the ground, and they barely get enough X-Wings in there for support. So I would assume that would already be a priority. But sure, just to be safe, let's try to get a message to them. However, the message is bring down the shield gate so we can send the data out, because we can't get the data out in a ship because the shield gate is on. But if you bring the shield gate down, then you could bring the data out on a ship. So why do you need to send it out as data if you bring the shield gate down?
I respect this logic.
Okay.
You're right. There are a couple little, like, honest trailers. Again, I'm imagining in my head is going to have any number of solutions for these things.
The answer is the Death Star is going to show up and blow things up. And so the data being transmitted is actually a safer way. But that's not the reason they do it at the beginning.
Right. And also, like, I guess it would be hard to get back down. Well, no, because the ship could take off and just pick them up at the little data tower, and then they go up through the ship.
The next one could just fly by, like, jump on board, throw me the data, whatever.
I will make the argument that it is riskier to fly from ground to orbit with it on a hard disk.
Which would make sense if that was the original plan.
Yeah.
Not the, oh, crap, they closed the shield gate on us. Now we need a new plan.
Mm.
Right.
So you're saying just the way they portrayed it to us just seemed too convenient for plot's sake.
It felt like they worked backwards a little too much, yeah. Mm.
Okay, fair enough.
But again, totally picking nits here and did not bother me. Even though I was thinking it, did not bother me. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I want them to get the data off. So that doesn't take away from the excitement, and that doesn't take away from the fact that, you know, we need to have that happen. Even if you fix those little points, it really doesn't change that much.
I just like the fact that the damn plans were on tape.
Hey, man, people still do tape backup today, so I guess.
No, I know. I legitimately liked it. It wasn't me going, oh, God, why is it on tape? I'm like, no, they're sticking to the 70s aesthetic. The Death Star had big square CRT monitors. Of course, it's on tape. Also,
it's more secure that way. It's cold storage. You don't need that on demand.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that also, I was thinking the same thing.
For security purposes, why would you have a giant transmitting satellite at the top of your building?
And not connected to anything else.
Oh, no.
That's another point, right? They say, what's that tower for? Well, you probably need a big dish to send all that data down there that is not connected, that you have to actually manually carry up and plug into a machine to send.
Which maybe if you were going to do that, you shouldn't have a giant tower anyway, because it'd be a lot easier to get it out like a spy. I don't know. Whatever. Nitpicks.
Finally, does it bother you that the Empire just blows up all of its archives?
Yes. Although I think with the size of the Empire, they probably had a backup archive.
I'm assuming they have redundant backups. Yeah.
I mean, you have to have it.
The plans were only in this location.
They apparently had redundant Death Stars. So,
they're only at the location to the knowledge of Galen. Maybe Galen didn't know about their offsite backup.
He doesn't know where their crash plan backup goes to. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Communications things.
That didn't bother me in the slightest. I'm like, yeah, the Empire is like Rome turned up to 11. Oh, you're going to burn our library? No, we'll burn our own library.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah.
A bit of silence for the plot hole. Okay. So, big battle on the ground. Fantastic. Love the X-Wings that make it through, knowing obviously it's a one-way trip. Love just really everything about that sequence. Nothing. I mean, it's clear they needed something for Bodhi to do. And I think that's why the message went there, because otherwise it's like, wait, with the ship.
Yeah, man. I felt bad for Riz Ahmed. I really like him. I don't know if you guys have seen The Night Of, but I thought he was fantastic in that series. I felt he was so underutilized in this movie. Also, his haircut bothered me the whole movie. That is not Imperial regulation hair, okay? If you're an Imperial, you don't have like long hippie hair.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe he'd been on the run for a little while, do you think?
For years?
From ear to neck. That's how long he'd been on the run.
From ear to neck.
That looked like a good year's worth of hair growth.
Yeah.
Oh. But I don't know. Maybe he's not human. Maybe he's a human-like alien, and their trait is that their hair grows really fast.
I think that's
fair. Maybe he's such a good pilot that he actually is allowed to fudge the rules.
Like a star pitcher.
Yeah, he's such a good cargo pilot.
The Empire doesn't do things that way. No.
And they're not the Yankees or anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I just felt I wanted more from him. He was a little underutilized. But I loved his scenes in this. I'm with you, Jenny. Like everything on the ground and in the air, like everything that was happening with the space battle, everything that was happening with the ground fight, like I was all in on it. It's
in 3D.
I did not see it in 3D. I never see a movie for the first time in 3D, and then typically I just avoid it entirely.
I saw them
both in 3D. Yeah. You too, Jenny?
It was pretty good. I don't feel like it was shot natively in 3D, but I feel like they did a pretty good job of it. I did not enjoy it.
I generally see 3D because it's a more convenient time.
Right.
Not because I want to see it in 3D, and I almost always forget that it's in 3D while I'm watching it.
Yeah, which is good, I think, because you already wear glasses. So, you know, it's just another.
Well, I don't wear glasses. I don't wear these glasses because they're reading glasses when I'm watching a movie. But also, it just doesn't matter. Like, I don't know. It should. If I'm paying extra for 3D, I should be like, wow, that was so good in 3D. And I never am.
I haven't felt that way since Avatar, basically.
Yeah.
Like, Avatar was the last movie that made me feel 3D magic.
That was the last movie I saw.
Not Airbender, the last 3D movie.
Yeah, that was the last movie where I felt it just was kind of like required to see it in 3D. I enjoyed Force Awakens in 3D. But honestly, kind of like you, Tom, I forgot that I was seeing it in 3D. The last time during my viewing of Force Awakens in 3D that I really thought about it was during the opening scene where they bring Poe past the frozen laser bolt. That's mm-hmm. where I'm like, oh, that's really good use of 3D. And then I just kind of forgot about it from there on out.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just like, nice. Okay, so it gets really sad, and everybody dies.
Yep, pretty much.
That's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Pretty much.
We have one more Uncanny Valley to cross before we can end this recap, which is, I have to say that I thought it was pretty darned slick that the Tantive, four?
Yeah.
Five?
Yep.
Tantive four. Was hiding in the belly of a Mon Calamari ship. That
slick
was slick.
Or irresponsible?
Both. I think probably that ship was on the way to let her off to go to Tatooine and then got diverted and ended up in a major battle. And
That's a good explanation. Because I'm like, does Bail know she's there? Because that seems like a really bad idea to have Princess Leia in the middle of a battle on Scarif.
And I think that was an accident because clearly them going, the major air forces, space forces going to Scarif was a last minute decision. So they were like, nope, got to reroute. And she's like, wait a second, I'm a princess. Get me to my location. But I had that amazing feeling of, oh, my God, I know what's coming. And I really did, like, not to underplay the moment on the beach or whatever, because that was very touching and wonderful and sad. But, like, then to follow the plans from how it got to the ship and then how it got through the hallway and Darth Vader chasing people through the hallway and the last guy through can't get through, but he hands off the plans. Like, that was great. And then it ends up in fake Princess Leia's hands and she ends the movie. I mean, holy cow, you guys. How did we feel about fake Princess Leia?
Eileen and I called it. Eileen and I said, I bet we see them hand the plans to Leia. We actually were like, I hope we see them hand the plans to Leia, or maybe we just see the back of her, right? And they're like, the princess, we have the plans, and that's the end of the movie. And they went one step farther than we had expected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this CGI, I feel, works great because it's close up. It apparently was a body double that they then CGI animated with Carrie Fisher's face, but it didn't need to be. Like, that could just be her saying the line "Hope" from an outtake from 1977, and I feel like that's what it would look like. In fact, that probably wouldn't even look as good as that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I thought it was pretty creative, but it's funny. I think the CG dies for me in the close-ups. The scenes with Tarkin, I thought, that worked the most is when it was more pulled out and he was a little more in shadow. So I feel if we had, because again, it was so pulled in, I'm just like, yep, okay, more Patrick Stewart at the end of Wolverine Origins, here we go. It's the close-ups for me that killed it. Much like Tarkin, it's like, yes, she has to be there. This is how it has to end. I'm glad they went this way. I just wish they had just decided on a different composition for that end shot.
Yeah, that's fair. I will say my entire theater screamed out loud when they saw Princess Leia.
Yes, mine
so,
too.
I mean, screamed. Like, not even like clapped and applauded. Like, it was genuine shock and awe.
Yeah.
So I think that was, it achieved its intended effect for my rather, you know, snooty and sophisticated Friday Night ArcLight audience. They were just like, holy cow.
Mine started losing their minds just when we saw the back of her.
Yeah. Mine started losing their minds when they saw the guys in the hats.
Oh, yes.
Tantive IV helmets.
Yes.
We were like, oh my God. Like, it was just amazing.
I have to get my Darth Vader fanboy out of my system too, by the way, because that final sequence, I was at, like, seeing that the movie was about to end, like, I could feel the ending coming. I'm like, I'm coming to terms with, holy shit, they killed everyone, everyone is dead, and I'm coming to terms with that. And at the same time, I'm like, this movie's almost over. I've seen almost no Vader, and I was actually kind of disappointed with the Vader scene. Mm. And then that scene happens, and I was just like, that is what I have always wanted my entire life as a Darth Vader fanboy, is just that Jason Voorhees as Darth Vader. Like, he doesn't talk. He just walks towards you, and there is nothing you and your 20 friends can do about it. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so we've now gone for an hour and a half. Anyone have any other thoughts?
Well, where do I start? No. I know there were lots of Easter eggs, and maybe we'll talk about some more of those as more of them are uncovered, although I think we've talked about a lot of them. For Star Wars Rebels fans, Ghost, as we mentioned previously, does show up.
Many times.
But also General Syndulla gets paged on the Rebel base. So Hera gets a shout out, and Chopper allegedly appears in the movie. I didn't notice him the first time around. I found out he's in it. So I tried to find him the second time through, and I heard him the second time through, and I saw movement of a droid, but I didn't quite catch it enough to be able to recognize him as Chopper, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I've heard about it after the fact, didn't see it. Katie was like legitimately let down when I told her she loves Chopper from the animated series, so I'm glad he made it in there. I'm curious.
Well, the Princess Leia scene has made it to YouTube, so maybe the Chopper scene will make it soon.
I'm curious if Rebels is going to do a crossover with this, if we're going to see the part that they played in this battle.
I don't know. That's a really good question of whether we'll get that far, because Rebels is supposed to wind up before A New Hope, but this could be, you know, where we get to. I assume Ezra doesn't make it that far, or else
there'd be a Jedi on the
there'd
ground
be another
helping.
Possible Jedi out there,
or Kanan.
It's a big
I know
universe.
Saw Gerrera is coming to Star Wars Rebels.
Oh, good.
They will get to meet Saw prior to Rogue One.
I really enjoyed Forrest Whitaker's take on the character, and his costume was phenomenal. That was another one. Like, I kind of wish we got a little more time with him and his mercenaries. But I guess I'm happy with the mercenary attack on the Imperial convoy. That was a great scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love the creatures. Actually, we didn't talk about the creatures. The creature design in this film, I thought, was just out of the park. And, the one little creature that was part of Guerrera's mercs, I guess it was 100% practical. That was a mask with animatronics, and they had puppeteers off screen, old school, like Jim Henson Creature Shop style. Like, and I thought it was effective.
That guy was great. I don't have a character name for him yet, but he was just like perfect Star Wars.
I'll let you know when I find his action figure and buy it.
So can I speed round through some emails? Because we've covered a lot of stuff in it, but I just was like, people have been writing us since the moment this movie was out, and I just want to recognize. Jeff Ganong writes, he saw Rogue One with his 8-year-old son. He would have rather had the movie go the Mon Mothma route for Tarkin and Leia and trust the audience to make the leap. And I think we answered the question of how we feel about the fan service cameos, which is to say, mostly they worked, and with Ponda Baba, we were all just like, all right, we'll forgive you.
I didn't need that one. That one was the most extraneous, the kind of most egregious fan service.
Yeah. That went beyond the blue milk into
the crossover to Buttface and the Doctor?
Yes.
Yeah, Buttface and the Doctor.
Buttface and the Doctor, which will be my next band name.
To give credit where credit is due, Brian in Indy is the one who came up with the Firefly scenario, and I really thought that was great. And I think, you know what, if you have Alan Tudyk in a movie, Tudyk, Genie is going to get mad at me, but it's really nice to make a reference to where we all first knew him from. Tim Watson also feels like maybe there were some good actors like Guy Henry, he says, who might have been in Grand Moff Tarkin, or Angus Wright. But he does like the trend of people using older British actresses in small, odd roles, including Harriet Walter in The Force Awakens and Geraldine James as Blue 3, saying one line and possibly exploding in Rogue One. So that was good. And then Chris Davenport writes, These two I'm going to save because these are actually about other movies, and we'll get to those in the next episode. So I will hold on to these two. We're going to be all Rogue One for this one. So
teaser, a very specific teaser for Chris that his email will be right on.
Chris and Billy, hang in there. We'll get it next one.
Be on the January episode of Let's Talk About Star Wars.
Yep.
I think before we go, who do you around the table? Who went out the coolest? Who had the best death?
That's so hard to compare because Chirrut goes out heroically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Baze goes out manically.
I don't remember. How did Bodhi go out? I don't remember.
Bodhi gets blown up. They throw a grenade in the ship.
He goes out rather poorly. I liked how Baze went, because when we meet Chirrut and Baze, we find out that they were both at one time part of this Guardians, and that Baze has lost his faith. So I like at the end that he picks up the chant and just aces some fools before going out.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good subtle little bit.
Actually, K2SO is my favorite.
No, for me, it's K2.
He does the most. And you know, contrary to his rhetoric, is devoted to the end, not just because Cassian told him to be.
Exactly. I love that right before he goes, just the final shot of him, he's just smoldering. He has so many laser blasts in his hull, and it's so cool looking. And then, to destroy the console, he just smashes it.
Well, then I will take as my favorite deaths Cassian and Jin on the beach, because those are two very sad, lonely people. And at least they found each other at the end, at the very last actual millisecond. And cheers for not making them kiss. Like, good job there. Good restraint. I think that one I felt was the most emotionally affecting. But I think K2SO was a close second.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Actually, I take it all back. The Calamari cruiser that hyperspaced into a Star Destroyer coming out of hyperspace was my favorite death of the film. That was so cool.
And the Corvette that pushed. Oh, my God. We haven't even talked about the Corvette pushing one Imperial Star Destroyer into another into the thing. That was amazing. Yep, are you kidding?
That Hammerhead Corvette shows up in Rebels, which ties Rebels directly to the Old Republic, because that's a updated design from the Old Republic. So we now have something from the Old Republic kind of in a canon film. Yes.
That's amazing. Yeah, the space battle is a whole nother conversation that I would need to see the movie again to have really well.
There's so much going on in there.
So much going on.
We barely touched on the use of footage from A New Hope to relay lines of the same pilots that were in A New Hope to bring some continuity, and then the way they mimicked the attack on the Death Star with the attack on the shield gate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's always a small hole that you got to deal with somewhere. One way or another, whether it's planet sized or whatever, there's always something you've got to shoot something into. And
Womp rat sized.
Yeah, something Womp rat sized, or proportionally speaking, Womp rat sized.
Or something Star Destroyer sized in the case of this movie.
Yeah.
But indeed. Well, awesome. I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode. I'm so glad we got to do this. I've been looking forward to this all day. Around the table, Jenny, where can folks find you when you're not talking about Star Wars?
Like on the floor hiding from my mother-in-law. No, I'm just kidding. I love her. It's so great to have her here for Christmas. Where am I? Go look up on iTunes a podcast called Make Me Smart with Kai Rizdal and Molly Wood. I'm producing it. It's doing little mini episodes through the end of the year and a little in January, and then launching January 24th after inauguration. It's going to be fun and smartish, and I'm really excited about it.
Very cool. How about yourself, Tom Merritt?
Well, and I'm not talking about Star Wars. I might be talking about Twin Peaks with Ron Richards on DamnFinePodcast.com. So please check in. We are in the midst of season one rewatch. We'll be rewatching all of season two as well, and hopefully leading right up until the return of the show to Showtime. So come rewatch along with us, DamnFinePodcast.com.
Awesome. Folks, you can find me on Twitter at GarrettArt, and every other podcast I do can be found over at amove.tv. That's AMOVE.TV. Go check it out. I'm just happy we got through this. Woo. And I'm excited to get it out into the world. Drop us 5-star reviews on iTunes if you like the show. If you really like the show, go to patreon.com/letstalkaboutstarwars and support us there. And a huge thanks to the Andrew Allen Trio, who's making me fail to speak at the moment, for their intro and outro music. Check out their music at andrewallentrio.com/music and grab their Star Wars tribute album. It would make a good Christmas present. Although at this point, it might not get there on time. Find on Amazon, hopefully. 2-day shipping. Get it there. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And until next time, embrace someone you love on the beach.
Always.
White slavers.